Hello, podcast listeners.
Y'all sound good
in
those headphones.
In the land of podcasts. Hello, financial professional looking for a podcast that can help you. Today's your lucky day. This is Open Windows. My name is Julie Mochin. Open Windows is a podcast created especially for financial professionals looking for a way to manage their own clients. 401ks, 403bs, or 457 accounts.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Open Windows Investing with the Pacific Financial Group and me, Julie Mochin. So today's episode, I have a really spectacular guest, David Blanchett, Managing Director and Head of Retirement Research for PGIM, which is Prudential. They're DC Solutions, which DC means defined contribution. So PGIM DC Solutions, if you want to get acronymical. Anyway, I got in touch with David because I heard he was retiring.
People, I'd like to announce my retirement from the male modeling profession.
No. Hoping there are Zoolander fans out there, because if not, that didn't make any sense. So the real reason I'm having David today is not because he is retired, but he does talk a lot about retiring, and he does a boatload of research that includes a lot of studies on retirees, participants of group retirement plans. Check out the backlinks. There's a ton of papers that he's written or had a hand in. It's really impressive. Anyway, on episode 3, there was made mention to one of his research papers. It was Matt Summer from Janus Henderson was making mention to this great article that he'd read with some terrific research about the March 2020, you know, when we figured out that there was a worldwide pandemic happening. What took place in the market? What did investors do? Retirement savers, did they jump ship? What was going on? Anyway, my guest, David Blanchett, did what he does, and he did a lot of research and had a hand in a paper that I couldn't find. I couldn't find it because he had left Morningstar. So long story short, I'd asked him to come on to the podcast because he's sort of like a superstar in our industry when it comes to research, and I'm really excited to be able to have him. Before we talk to David about a lot of really great stuff, I want to tell you quickly what we do here at the Pacific Financial Group. If you're not familiar with us, remember the two words Strategy Plus, because that's our turnkey asset management platform that is built specifically for advisors helping their clients in group retirement plans, whether it's a 403B, 401K, or 457 plans. What we're able to do there is give you a platform to choose well over 30 different models that are customized to suit your client, their risk tolerance, their lifestyle. We do enhanced target date models. We do Index Plus, which is enhanced index models if they like passive underlying investing. We do ESG. We have partners that are best in class in the industry. You'll know every one of the names that have partnered with us here to help, because everyone realizes there's a crisis with retirement plans not being able to really give what the participant needs. And that's customized advice that suits them to help them get to retirement. I suggest you check it out, because I'm sure you have clients that are working and that have a 401k, 403b, or 457, and you haven't really been able to give them advice without taking on fiduciary responsibility. And you don't really want to take on fiduciary responsibility and not get paid, because this is your business. You have a family to take care of as well. Obviously, your client comes first. So we are here for you to get you trained, to give you what you need for this marketplace, and to make sure that we have the follow-up services to keep everybody as happy as we possibly can. All right, let's do this. David Blanchett, welcome to Open Windows.
Sure.
First question I have for you is, how did you get into this business? How did you get here?
So I used to be a financial planner. If we go back like 20 years. So I actually sold life insurance in college for a few years. And one of the things I learned when I was selling life insurance is that the products and services that certain companies may want you to sell isn't always in the client's best interest. And so both of my parents were teachers, so I was very interested in education at a young age. And so I started taking tests in college. I actually took the CFP when I was like 20. I finished the CFA when I was 24. And I always really enjoyed financial planning. I didn't plan on being a researcher when I started in the field, say 20 years ago. But over time, the more that I've been in the industry, the more that I've enjoyed to kind of you know, actually ask the question, well, what actually makes the most sense for an advisor or client to do? And so 20 years now, I've been doing that. And now my job is largely or almost entirely focused on research, thought leadership, and kind of building a variety of products and solutions.
As I know, you're an adjunct professor at the American College of Financial Services. For anybody out there that's listening that doesn't know what sort of designation they want to get or what direction they want to go, maybe you can shed some light on that for us.
Sure. So the American College is a professional education organization. They're perhaps best known for designations like the CLU, the CHFC, and the RICP. I actually helped kind of create a new designation called the WMCP, but they're really focused on educating advisors to kind of help them, you know, give better advice and create better outcomes.
So if someone's working on their CFP or CFA, should they still look at that?
I mean, you could. I mean, I think so I'm a certified financial planner. I've gotten designations through the American College, the CLU, the CHFC. There's a lot of overlap there. If you want something, you know, more quantitative, you could always go the CIMA or the CFA route. The American College does have two designations that are kind of more retirement focused. There's the RICP and the WMCP. So there are designations that you could look at there. But I see like if you've gotten the CFP, then you've spent years learning the, you know, more than just the basics in terms of financial planning. So it's not to say that there aren't designations for you at the American College, but I think at that point you should kind of ask yourself, well, what do I want to dig deeper into? And then find the designation that kind of works best there.
All right, that makes sense. Burning question for many here. I'm not sure if you can answer this question that I want to ask, but you were at Morningstar for, over 10 years, maybe doing incredible research, and then you recently made a change, and I found that out because I couldn't find certain pieces that you were working on. What went down there?
Sure. So with respect to research, like nothing has changed. I'm still an adjunct at the American College. I still work a lot with the Alliance for Lifetime Income. I'm still DC focused. I still have effectively free reign to kind of cover a whole host of topics. If anything, you know, a motivation for the change was to join an organization, Prudential, that had a record keeper at the time as an asset manager in an insurance company. I loved the decade I spent at Morningstar, but I wanted to kind of try something new. So I don't think that anyone that has been following me should expect any less in the near term. If anything, I've actually been able to get access to some really interesting data that I probably wouldn't have gotten if I'd still been at Morningstar. So I hope to be kind of sharing some even more interesting possible research in the near future. So for me, I don't know that I have a 5 or a 3 year or 10 year plan. It's just to kind of keep doing good research, keep advancing the profession. So that's pretty much it.
So you hear the word retirement all the time. You use the word retirement all the time. I do a bazillion times a day as well. One thing I think about, and I think it's because I have a lot of younger friends, is retirement going to become obsolete? I mean, is it going to exist in the future?
So I actually don't love the word retirement. I don't think that I will ever retire. And that's ironic because my title is the head of retirement research. I like the term financial independence more, right? That's actually, I think, what most people are saving for. It's the chance to do whatever they want. And so I think that it's true that as our society lives longer, as we have more jobs that aren't, you know, physically demanding, retirement could be a very active life for people versus maybe what it was, say, 100 years ago. So I think retirement still fits, but you're really kind of saving for when you're older and when you want to maybe do something other than what you do right now.
So financial independence?
Yeah. And now I don't like, so there's the whole FIRE thing that's out there, like the financially independent, retire early. I think that some of that's a little bit nuts. Like it doesn't make any sense to just like, you know, not enjoy your money and stuff. But I do like the idea of financial, and like that to me is the crux of retirement. It's being financially independent. You don't have to work, but that could also mean volunteering. It could mean a second job. It could mean starting a franchise. It could mean lots of things. The key is that you're kind of out of the main workforce, potentially not earning, doing what you were for 20 or 30 or 40 years.
So David, tell us a little bit about, and this goes way back, but some research you did, I think it was called the retirement smile, or what was that? What does that mean?
It's about retirement happiness. No, it's okay. So it has to do with the assumptions that people use when it comes to a financial plan as well as how retirees spend or consume in retirement, right? So the vast majority of financial planning tools of any kind of projection assumes that individuals increase their spending every year in retirement by inflation. So it literally suggests that if inflation is 3.2%, that the person calls up their advisor, you know, instantly and says, hey, inflation was up 3% last year. I need a 3% raise. And they do that every single year for, say, 30 years in retirement. Well, if you actually look at the data on how spending evolves in retirement, so you track the same households over time, what you tend to see happen is that younger retirees, say those that are, say, 55, they actually tend to spend a little bit more versus inflation. If they're active, they can do things. As you kind of move through retirement, it kind of declines. So you're, if inflation goes up 3%, you only maybe spend 1% more, but at the very end of retirement, so if you're like age 100 and you're still alive, there's an increasing chance of these really significant medical costs. Now, you know, the median is less than the average, but the longer that you survive in retirement, kind of the higher the probability of having this kind of big shock might be. And so you can see spending actually increase, at least on average, at these really older ages. So it forms this thing that I dub the retirement spending smile.
All right. So if I'm an advisor helping a client, how do I fix that?
You know, like the one thing that I think is really important to do is to not necessarily, I mean, I think it's okay to assume that the spending amount increases by inflation is like the base case, because I mean, you know, like retirement healthcare is like a really scary thing. It's hard to kind of hedge against, but there's a very real possibility that the average person does not increase their spending every year by inflation. And why that's so important is, you know, I want people to enjoy retirement. That's why you retire, is to do cool and fun stuff. And, you know, there's often a lot of trade-offs you have to make. And, you know, like, do you take that cruise when you're 68? Well, you know, I wouldn't want someone to have this big, you know, pile of money when they're 98 years old they didn't spend and use most effectively. So I think the key is kind of showing someone maybe different scenarios, saying, hey, if we change this assumption from, you know, you're going to spend the same amount every year to maybe match, you know, this more realistic spending pattern, how does that maybe free up some money for you to do things that you might enjoy doing earlier in retirement?
Yeah, great advice, because, you know, depending on what someone is exposed to, there are people out there that feel like they'll never have enough money. And from personal experience, I feel that a lot of times women tend to do that, where they, you know, they're afraid of not having enough money when they're much older, that they're not spending it. And speaking of women, what do you see as far as, I don't know if you're working on any research right now, but what do you see as far as trends for women in the workplace and as retirement savers?
There's a few things. You know, one, this idea of like an uninterrupted 35-year, 40-year accumulation period is at the same company is just not realistic at all anymore, right? I think that there's going to be lots of breaks in jobs, potentially just breaks from working to do different things. And I think that applies more to women than men, given their role as a primary caregiver for not only their own children, but also adult parents. And so I think that, you know, it's highly likely, you know, increasingly likely that you know, people will have these breaks in employment. They're going to have things happen. And that's just kind of part of the new normal when it comes to planning for retirement.
What do you feel about Social Security? Easy for me to say. How do you feel about Social Security? Is it going to be around?
I get a little angry when I hear that. I mean, so even if Social Security reverts to pay-go, right? So pay as you go, just based upon receipts, it's about 80% funded. Okay, so I mean, from my perspective, Social Security is a government like social welfare program to ensure that grandmother does not live on cat food and not have any money, right? It will never go away. We as a society, we are the ultimate first world country. You know, it will never fail. Now, can it change? Yes. Do we need to modify the calculations? Yes. But this notion that like it's not going to be there, I think, is ridiculous. Now, you know, I'm 40. Right. You know, I think it'll look very different when I retire, you know, quote unquote, retire in 20 or 30 years, where, you know, there could be additional means testing, there could be additional taxes. But at its core, you know, its goal is to create a minimum income benefit for all Americans. Now, that could mean in changes for folks that have a lot of money saved for retirement, but it doesn't change the crux of the program, which is ensuring that everyone has some base minimum income when they retire.
I know there's a ton of variables, and it's hard for you to maybe answer this without all of the facts, but when should someone start taking Like, typically, when should they start taking Social Security?
So the earliest you can claim benefits is 62. You can technically claim as old as you want, but there's no benefit to claiming past age 70. There's some important considerations here. So one, like if you have a choice, it implies that you have money saved for retirement. You know, if you've got nothing saved for retirement, you're going to claim as soon as you can. So let's kind of first caveat this discussion with, okay, I've saved a lot of money for retirement. For the vast majority of folks, it's going to make sense to claim as late as possible. We'll call it age 70. Okay. Someone's going to be listening and saying, well, David, you know, like I'm not that healthy, whatever else. Well, and so, okay, I get like health is a big deal. Okay. But a point that I like to make out about health and why I think a lot of break-even calculators don't make a whole lot of sense is if you die when you're 75 years old, your kids get all your stuff. Right. But if you've delayed claiming, you know, assuming you're the primary earner, then your spouse gets a larger benefit for life. Right. So I think that a problem with like this notion of like break even claiming age is that it's focused on like maximizing wealth, when to me, like the ultimate negative outcome is someone surviving to like 110 and depleting their kids' resources because they go broke. So I think like the notion of, you know, like break even needs to be in the context of like what is the true bad outcome. Additionally, like Social Security doesn't adjust based upon interest rates. And so right now, it's like a really, really, really good deal because interest rates are super low. If interest rates rise a ton and it's not adjusted, then there's going to be a reason to possibly claim sooner. But right now, it is like an absolute no-brainer layup that you should delay claiming as long as you possibly can. Assuming you're not like about to die tomorrow, that you're in reasonable health. Even the thing is, even if you are though, the increase in the spousal benefit, if you're the higher earner, could make it worth it as well. So even if you're not in good health, there's other benefits of Social Security that make it very attractive. It's linked to inflation. It's taxed advantage. There's the survivor benefit. So I really do think that most Americans that have a choice should wait as long as they can.
I saw a piece that you were working on that I'll make sure I backlink that's called 401k menus are not retirement ready, I think is what it was called. Can you give us a scoop on that?
Sure. So 401ks have been primarily an instrument to help people accumulate wealth for retirement. And I think they've done a pretty good job at that. I mean, there's a few haters out there that don't like 401ks. Well, in life, it's always versus what. And if you're not in a 401k, you're not saving for retirement. So they've done a phenomenal job for those that have access to them to help them accumulate some wealth. They could be improved. Let's just move beyond that. But the problem is that a lot of them are too focused on accumulation. And more plan sponsors, more Americans, etc., like the 401k environment, you've got institutional investments, you've got professional fiduciaries, you've got lots of good stuff. And so I think what we're seeing is more and more participants in 401k plans want to remain in them in retirement. Well, the problem is that a lot of 401k plans aren't retirement ready. They don't have, for example, like they don't allow partial withdrawals. There's not advice. Well, you know, what this research focused on is the investment menu. And, you know, most of the investments in 401k plans are very growth focused. There's lots of, you know, U.S. equity, international equity funds. There's not a lot of diversifiers in terms of fixed income or alt. And so I think the perspective of the research was like, I think that they've done a good job of helping folks get to retirement, but they're not necessarily ready in terms of being an optimal solution for decumulation unless we add more investments to give participants the ability to build better portfolios using the core menu.
Yeah, and that's right up our alley here at TPFG. You know, we offer advisors a platform to give participants in-plan advice and options that are much more robust than, you know, the general core options. So, all right, I want to talk about the research that you submitted to, I don't know where, Journal of Retirement, maybe? I'll make sure I backlink this, obviously. But practical applications of do advisors improve 401k plans. So for anybody who's listening to this, I'm going to ask David now, are you talking about advisors to the plan or advisors to the participant? Because obviously they're two totally separate things and I have not read the research thoroughly yet. So I don't know if you've done research on both. I'd love to hear about it. If it's just one, you could let us know. So yeah, you know, advisors for the plan sponsor versus participant.
So I've actually researched both to some extent, and the answer for both is yes. In that, you know, there's evidence that plans that have an advisor are better run. Now, there's this like weird statistical thing called endogeneity. I always say it wrong, but like it could be that plans that select advisors would have made better choices without them. But if you compare investment menus, you know, all these aspects of what any a professional fiduciary would say is good or bad, without a doubt, plans that have advisors, especially smaller plans, do a better job. And, you know, I think that's a really important caveat by smaller plans, is because if you're a really big plan, like $1 billion 401k, you have a staff of folks running the plan who are professional investment fiduciaries, DC experts. If you've got a plan that's got $6 million, that's like one of 1,000 things you just don't have time to worry about. And so I think where the advisors add the most value is when you have an organization, an employer doesn't have the resources to really dedicate, you know, hiring 3 people to run the plan. So I think that is where there's unequivocal evidence. Having an advisor definitely leads to better plans. And along these same lines, I've done research too that suggests that having an advisor can lead to better outcomes if you're someone that would make poor decisions. If you're not good at investing, if you're not going to stay the course, if you need help on, you know, on how much to save, advisors can add tons of value. Obviously, the value differs a lot by the quality of the advisor, the type of person, but there is a growing body of evidence that does suggest that planners, advisors can add value in lots of domains.
By the way, I love firing questions off at you because you're like, boom, boom, boom. Here's all the answers. All right, here's a good one. I'm going to use acronyms. No, I'm not. The pooled employer plan versus the multiple employer plan. Again, the pooled employer plan, the PEP, versus a multiple employer plan, the MEP. And these were, they both come out under the Secure Act? I don't even know. MEPs and PEPs. Give us your take on those.
Sure. So there's always been this thing called like multiple employer plans or MEPs, right? Where you could have like a trade organization that has a bunch of car dealerships, you know, get together and have their own plan. There are problems with the approach from like wider adoption, like the common nexus requirement and like the notion of one bad apple spoiling the bunch. And the creation of PEPs have kind of eliminated those concerns. I like the idea of PEPs fundamentally. A lot of folks said that, once we have PEPs, we're going to have more plan sponsors offering plans. In my experience, you know, if I have 8 employees, whether the plan costs 1% or 3%, it's not going to affect my decision to offer a plan. So I don't know that PEPs will, you know, really, really, truly affect the access of 401k plans to participants, you know, across the U.S. I think that was one of the reasons they were kind of excited. But I do think they will improve quality. I think that it gives a way for, different groups to pull together and get, economies of scale through forming PEPs. So, I don't know where that is going to be headed, but I like it as an alternative to maybe, you know, other ways, other strategies that exist right now to hopefully drive down pricing, increase quality in the 401k space.
Okay, a couple more quick questions, David, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You did some outstanding research on how participants of retirement plans reacted to volatility in the markets. And I think what I read was based on March 2020. But can you expand on what research you did and what you found there?
Sure. So I have like a recurring joke that, you know, I love a good market downturn so we can test and see what's working and what's not for investors, right? So I did research back in 2008, looking at trading activity, looking at RTQ responses for individuals. I've done a bunch of research now looking at how participants in 401k plans responded to the volatility. It was a relatively brief downturn, lasted like a quarter or two, but there's really strong evidence that, you know, one, participants that are in a professionally managed solution, like managed accounts or a target date fund, whether they selected it themselves or were defaulted, traded less. And so clearly delegation is a good thing for behaviors. But along the same lines, the folks that made like the worst timing decisions that were the most active are older participants. And, you know, this is actually counterintuitive if you're a research nerd like me, because in theory, if you're like 60 years old, let's just say, you've been investing for 20 or 30 or 40 years. You should know how markets work. You have a higher income. By virtually any metric that you would use in economics, you would describe that person as more sophisticated than someone who is, say, 30 years old. In reality, though, those older investors are the ones who are the most likely to trade
given market volatility. And I think the reason, right, is because of the salience of retirement. All of a sudden, you know, if you're like 40 years old and your 401k is down, you're like, whatever, I'm going to retire in 20 or 30 years. But if you're 60 years old and you're retiring in 3 years and your portfolio drops by 20%, you're like, man, I was going to get 40K a year. Now it's only like 32K. I can't do that. I got to get out. And so I think the problem there is that, you know, it creates a situation if you're not a, you know, if you can't be a long-term investor, where you're going to make poor decisions. And this happened in 2020. You know, there was a ton of folks who were in, you know, a target date fund or an aggressive portfolio who sold out early and lost money. And so I think that my concern, right, is that there's evidence that investors don't appear to get kind of smarter with age. If anything, as they approach retirement, they need help more to ensure that they can kind of stay the course if things do get a little crazy.
Yeah, human nature gets you every time. What do you think we're going to see from you coming up here, 2022 and beyond? I mean, do you have anything that you can let us in on that you're researching currently?
I literally have, I think, 5 to 10 active papers at any given time. So I'm not always looking at just one thing. I mean, I think that, you know, like the larger themes that I'm interested in are really helping plan sponsors figure out how to help their participants have better retirements. But it's not realistic to think that every American will get a high quality financial plan at a good fee every year. And so I think that the 401k DC space is a really, really good environment to help, you know, especially middle America achieve a great retirement. And so there's lots of things that I think that we can do as a society to improve that. So that's kind of, you know, a big focus. But then just all the little things. I think that there is a, you know, a benefit, for example, to having more guaranteed income. I don't want to use the A word as part of a retirement strategy. I think that you know, like we can build better portfolios. There's lots of things that we can do to help investors achieve better outcomes. And kind of anything that perks my ear that does that is stuff that I try to work on. So
any advice for someone just starting out in the business or thinking about getting into it?
Well, I mean, it's kind of a treacherous profession early on, right? You literally know nothing about how to help people, and you have to go out and build a book of business. And that necessarily isn't the best environment. I mean, I think that, you know, to truly be successful, you know, we need a better track for folks to follow. You join a company as a para planner or in some capacity where you can, you know, at least, you know, learn the profession, you know, learn how things work without, you know, an aggressive sales quota. And then over time, you kind of build your knowledge and then build a book. I mean, I would, you know, I get a little nervous when I've friends all the time that, you know, give the profession a go. And some of them have been wildly successful, and it does happen. But I mean, anyone that's been in this business for a few decades has seen many, many folks come and go. So I think that if there are ways to kind of, you know, find a way, an entry point where maybe it won't pay as well early on, but it gives you the chance to actually learn from someone, learn about the profession and kind of ease your way into it. That's a much better way than, you know, hey, you've got to learn what planning is and hit aggressive sales targets for the next 3 years, because what ends up happening is that, you know, most folks fail. They don't always give good advice, and it isn't good for the profession. So I wish that we could kind of create a better way to kind of get newer folks, you know, integrated into the profession, because it would lead to better outcomes for them and better outcomes for individuals that get the advice.
Thank you for saying that. It's not good for the profession. It's not good for the clients, obviously, and it's not good for the profession because it like cheapens the entire process. It shouldn't be that way. And it's because, well, that's another podcast completely. Last question. I keep saying last question. Last question, though. I think you're the only person I know from Kentucky. You're from Kentucky, right?
Indeed. Born, raised, and reside.
All right. And that's bluegrass country. What's your favorite kind of music?
So I don't know that I have a favorite almost anything. I mean, I don't, bluegrass is not a regular. I like all kinds of music. So I'm, you know, I run whenever I can, and it is the most eclectic combination of music. It's like rap, and it's like old school, and it's like country. And things that have a good beat, you know, like it's, I don't know, for some reason, certain songs resonate with me and I love them, but it's not usually just one particular genre.
Yeah, I get it. If you're a runner, there are certain songs that get you up and over the next hill. and to the finish line. Hey, thanks so much for all the time you gave us today. Everyone appreciates you. And for the listeners, everything will be in the show notes for you. And also check out TPFG Strategy Plus if you want to be able to give some in-plan advice to your clients.
All right. There you have it. Until the next episode, remember, you don't need to work harder, just work smarter by opening a window. This is Julie Mochin with the TPFG Open Windows Investing Podcast, signing off.
This podcast recording has been prepared and made available by the Pacific Financial Group Incorporated, also known as TPFG, a registered investment advisor offering advisory services. Information in this podcast is to be used for informational purposes only. The information contained herein, including any expressions of opinion, has been obtained from or is based on sources believed to be reliable, but its accuracy or completeness is not guaranteed and is subject to change without notice. This information should not be construed or interpreted as an offer or solicitation to purchase or sell a financial instrument or service. Any expressions or opinions reflect the views of the speakers and are not necessarily those of TPFG or its affiliates. TPFG does not provide tax or legal advice. Investors should consult their financial, tax, or legal professionals before investing. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and all investments contain risk, to include the total loss of invested principal. Diversification does not protect against the risk of loss. Have a nice day.